Accession number 30078, real 4.
In the bungalows, we had four people to a bungalow. I had Henry Appleyard, Johnny Bland, and myself, just three. The bungalow would have been built, I presume, about 1830, 1840. It was a sort of a long bungalow, but again, we had adequate rooms each. In fact, we had more rooms than normal because there should have been a fourth officer in it. And you had a little enclosed courtyard, which actually was mine. They had to come out of their rooms and round and into the courtyard. So I was very much on my own and very, very happy in it too. I had a wonderful map of the world with the war charted, and the Germans seemed to advance ever closer to England. I thought, oh God, what will happen if they get England? I wonder whether we would have carried on as a separate army or what would happen. No idea.
How closely were you able to follow the progress of the war?
Well, by radio, easily. Well, I mean, as much as the radio wanted us to know. I still had my Emerson set that I was getting in, but of course I couldn't read Morse, so I didn't get the early news, but by that time they were having proper news broadcasts, proper times and so on. And one did get very downhearted once or twice when Rommel advanced across the desert to quite near Cairo. The Germans up north had taken all of France and were facing England. One thought, well, what will happen to us? Will we, if England packs in, do we just say, right, hands up, or do we go on, or does the King go to Canada and we start the war with Canada, India, and so on? It wasn't a big subject, but it was a subject that you thought about occasionally. Meanwhile, there were more and more people in India who were against the war. There were riots. Even a training battalion had to be prepared to send men out onto riot control. This was a problem because you couldn't send recruits. You had to do your train service. So it meant that if you did send people out on riot, you had to take all the instructors away from the companies to form a group to go. So you sort of somehow or other looked after the recruits, somehow or other. Luckily, they were at various stages of training, so you took the senior recruits. They'd look, drill the junior ones and get on with it and do that. For me, it was a very happy period. I was doing a job I liked. I was my own boss. Colonel Hamlin was very easy with me. He was known as Titch Hamlin because he was about 5 foot high and 5 foot wide. He really was a little ball. And actually, he was not an efficient officer. To me, he was quite all right. But looking back and also discussing him with other officers who knew him and were efficient and made their names for themselves, he wasn't highly efficient, but he could hold a unit together, and as long as his staff worked for him, and we were quite happy to work for him, things ran along nice and smoothly. After the takeover by Montgomery in the desert, Auchinleck came back, and he became our Grenadier Colonel-in-Chief. There was a period when he did nothing when he came back, and then he became Commander-in-Chief of the Indian Army. He was our Colonel-in-Chief, which was quite a nice thing. It didn't really mean much, but occasionally you could say you wanted something and they say you can't have it, and you said, oh, well, I think I'll go and see our Colonel-in-Chief. And people say, oh, yes, yes, oh, we've got it for you, and that sort of thing. So more Indians came in. We had a very nice group of Indians. I'm only still in contact with one, Sultan, who lives in Pakistan now. If I may just go aside from my story for a moment, Sultan came to us, and I knew he was obviously different. He was very well educated and spoke good English, tall, handsome, good looking. I got quite friendly with him, and he was the son of one of the smaller Maharajas of one of the small states. There were many, many very small states, and he invited Chalky White and myself and Johnny Bland down to his wedding, and we stayed in the official guest house. The only time in my life I've ever seen a blue beige coloured billiard table. I've always seen a green all my life, but it had a blue, a light blue. Anyhow, just while I'm on the side on Sultan, he joined one of the battalions, came to partition. He doesn't know why to this day, but he said, oh, well, I opted to go to Pakistan on the Pakistan Civil Service. He went there, and if I would tell you that he became foreign minister, ambassador to Japan, ambassador to China, ambassador to Japan, ambassador to America, and high commissioner in England. You can guess what he was like. Very nice person indeed. He's still alive. He settled in America, but his wife got beginning of Alzheimer's rather badly, and needed to be looked after. And in America, 24 hours a day looking after people is very expensive, so he went back to Pakistan, lives in Karachi. Once a month I get a call from him still, "Hello Patrick, this is Sultan, how are you?" And he was, if you like, a very higher educated Indian officer. We got Indian officers of all types. Many of them were bloody good. They made excellent officers. There were one or two who were a bit questionable. And we also had a few, very, very few, who were ex-subedars, you know, subedar, jemadar, they're the Indian officers below commissioned rank, who had been commissioned and made into captains and that, and they were very good, usually because of their previous experience. They had problems fitting into the mess because suddenly they had to live like a European, exactly, whereas before the subedars in the Viceroy Commission officers' messes were obviously Indian entirely. But they were good. So things went happily on that way. We churned out recruits. I went on a 10-day field engineering course at Ratlam. We were paired off in threes, and it meant digging trenches and that. And I was paired off with two Welsh miners. It bloody near killed me. They were down about 20 feet before I'd got 1 foot down. That course, I never forgotten it. Damn near killed me. There were other things apart from digging, though, thank goodness. And I managed to get a 10-day military law course in Bombay, but that was mainly spent in chasing up the famous brothel road for Bombay. I can't remember the name of it now. I know it was Karaya Road in Calcutta. I forget the name of Bombay. But that was where Madame Andre and her sister were, who, as I say, financed what's her name, and then I met the sister as a retired lady from India. But apart from that, I did the adjutant's job happily, unimpeded by other people. I'm told I wasn't bad. I may not have been wonderful, but at least I got it done. Then they decided to expand us even more. We were going to become two training battalions within the centre. And each one of those would be commanded by a major. I was a captain's adjutant, acting a temporary captain by then. Each one of those would be commanded by a major. And at the same time, because we were getting weapons and instruments in which needed a bit of education, we were having problems in getting enough sepoys who could use them, who had the education. So it was decided to start what they called boys' companies. And we started enlisting boys at the age of 16. And the idea was to give them 2 years of recruit training, but intensive education. And this struck me as rather good. It's something unknown before. You could use your own ideas. And also, the way that promotion was going with service, I was due to be an acting major and therefore would have had to command one of the two battalions, which I didn't really relish the idea. But I like new things. So I said, right, I don't want to be a major if I can have the boys' company and somebody else take over adjutant. And luckily, Hamlin said yes. And I was really pleased with that because it was left up to me entirely how I formed the boys' battalion, exactly what I did. And they were, funnily enough, they were based up in the great big double-decker stone building that I'd been in when I was with the Lincolns, in the same building.
When was this?
Pardon?
When was this?
This would have been 43, middle 43 probably, around there. That probably was part of my army life I enjoyed most, because I was literally my own boss. And the boys were good to work with. I had a regular staff, I had a jemadar, a couple of havildars, and then various knights training proper soldiers and allotted them to platoons, broke the boys up into platoons. But I was able to get extra stuff for them, so I had them kitted out for special days in white, with each platoon a different coloured turban and so on, things like that, which sounds silly now, but it made a difference then, and they were proud of what they had. And we took them up full recruit training, but with lots and lots of education. Normally, a company would have one education Nike, that's education corporal. We had seven, and they worked hard with them. And we also had one of each of the type of weapons which were coming in, like the 6-pounder anti-tank gun, which the average sepoy wouldn't know how to work. We had one of each of those things that the boys would be instructed on as well, so they knew how they worked and that. Another side story, if you like, at a place of which name I've forgotten, but it's about 30, 40 miles out of Ajmer, there's a very famous holy Hindu lake, and it's surrounded by Hindu shrines all round it. And once a year they have an enormous celebration there. Camels come in from the desert and Indians come from everywhere. It's packed tight. And it was decided in 1944 that the army should be represented merely on a recruiting basis, really. And I asked, well, can I take some of the boys? So what we did is we took a 6-pounder gun, anti-tank gun down, a team of boys to work it really well. What I didn't tell people was that I planted them explosives at the far end of the arena, wired underground, and when it came to firing the gun, they fired a blank and I pressed a button and an explosive went up. The crowd thought they were real shells and people took off in all directions. There was chaos everywhere. But that was a very happy part with the boys, and I think we did turn out some excellent people. And I know before I actually had finished my service in India, many of them had become subedars. They'd gone up very, very quickly, accelerated.
Were you setting the curriculum? Were you responsible for the whole curriculum?
Yep. I mean, under advice as well, but I was responsible for sorting it all out and getting it done. And as I say, it was mainly normal military training, but all the education we could think of that would be connected with the big heavy 3-inch mortars coming in, the 6-pounder anti-tank gun, trucks, driving trucks, and all that sort of thing, to bring all that in as well, which of course took longer than it would for a normally recruit. I think a boy was with me for at least 2 years, or would have been. I didn't last out. So it went on. Anyhow, then they decided, because of the size of the regimental centre, to raise the rank of the commander. I mean, it was a full colonel instead of Hamlin, who was a lieutenant colonel. And so another grenadier came in from another battalion, Colonel Newton King, quite a nice person, but I didn't take to him very much. But then I didn't have a lot to do with it because I was running my boys' company. That was my arrangement. But I don't know, the wanderlust got into me and the desire to do something different, and I wanted something where I could be my own boss entirely. And I met a fellow who was with the CMPI, the Corps of Military Police, India, one day in Ajmer. And I was talking to him, what's your job like and what do you do? And he said, oh, every officer has a little command of his own. They either have a detachment they're commanding, or they're commanding a greater number with 4 or 5 detachments under one head. You're very much your own boss in that. And I thought, this sounds rather good, and you get around a bit. So much to my colonel's horror and Hamlin's horror, I suddenly went up one day and said, I want to finish with the boys' company. I want to get attached to the Corps of Military Police. You couldn't join it. You were attached to it. So I was, say, Bombay Grenadiers, brackets attached, CMPI. Anyhow, they tried to dissuade me, but no, I wanted to wander. The wanderlust got in. I also didn't want to be sent to war. I thought I'd be too frightened. And
on that subject, and going back, I suppose, how would the opening of the front with Japan affected your unit and the Indian Army as a whole?
Well, it affected me thinking, oh God, the war's getting awfully close, isn't it? Being a born coward, I thought, oh dear, this is terrible. I forgot to tell you, originally, when war was declared in England, one afternoon I was lying on my bed with my set playing, and suddenly it said, there's a special announcement. Mr. Chamberlain, I think it was, will announce. And he said, we are now at war with Germany. And you know what my first thought was? Oh God, did I join up for this? I thought, Christ, what's going to happen? Which I'm normally not allowed to say. You're the first person I've told it to. Anyhow, how it affected India, well, of course, First of all, it turned everything round. We'd been facing west and thinking of sending stuff to Egypt, and my own battalion, the 1st 4th Grenadiers, they were in Iran, what are called Pi Force. That was to keep the route open to Russia for oil and other things like that. They weren't actually fighting anybody, but they were ready to in case they were attacked, because the Germans wanted to try and come around that way. So it meant we had to switch our whole idea across to Burma. This meant a complete turnaround of the whole army and supplies, everything like that. And of course it meant the advent of jungle training. Well, what brought that on was, as you know, that we already had troops on that side, and it had been realized for some time that Japan was going to be a danger on that side, what with the advance in China and elsewhere. And then they went across into Siam. So a number of regiments had gone over there, not only grenadiers. And by this time, incidentally, the grenadiers had now been allotted a specific role. I had hinted at it when I talked about Colonel Franklin. They'd become motorized battalions. Now, a motorized battalion had never been formed before. Nobody knew what it was. But the plan was that when you were always attached to cavalry, one company would be attached to one cavalry regiment. And at night time, when the tanks lagered into circle, whatever it was the motor company's job to defend them. You do all their mobile defense around them and all that sort of stuff. So it was an odd kind of command, because a colonel would have four rifle companies and a headquarter company. Four of those would be with different cavalry regiments. Also, he had little to say to them, too. It was a very spread command. So we had to start motorizing our people. That was the first thing hit us. We had to teach the soldiers to drive, which they hadn't done. So we had to work like masses of lorries came in, and we had to teach them that. I managed to get some boys learning as well. I wangled off a couple of lorries. It also meant, of course, that the Japanese did what they were not meant to do. They walked through the jungle and took Singapore. And that shook people rigid. It really shook them. So they had to realize it to be a new type of training and everything. So jungle warfare centers were sent up, and the odd people who escaped, they became instructors and tried to teach people about jungle warfare. Here again, it was odd for us, because we had both to be in motors to protect the tanks, and people didn't know how tanks would work in the jungle, and it all had to be planned and worked out how they did. Apart from that, and apart from feeling the war was nearer, it just speeded up. Everything had to be done. More people had to be enrolled, more battalions were raised, training centers were raised by another company, and so on. The military police, of course, went wherever the troops went. And this idea, what I liked, is that every officer was his own commander. Every officer had a detachment. You weren't under a mass of others as you would be in a battalion. It's my old Bolshevik feeling coming out. So I applied, and my colonel reluctantly said, "Oh, well, if you really want to, you've been here in the training center a long time, so I'll recommend you." And then came what I think one of the biggest wastes of money the Army's ever done. I had to go for an interview to the district commander. The district was Nagpur, which was a night and a morning train travel away. So I went all night and all morning on train. Then I was put in a hotel. The next day I was told to see the commander. And he said, "Oh, yes, yes, yes. Now, what did you want?" "Ah, military police." "Oh, yes, well, are you physically all right for it?" And I said, "Well, I bust a bit of my leg." He said, "Oh, I broke my knee in the First World War." And for 10 minutes he told me the full story of his breaking his knee. Then he said, "Now, what was it you wanted?" And so I said, "Military police." He said, "Oh, yes, certainly, certainly," and signed the paper. And that was my entire interview. Then I had the whole night and morning journey train back to where I'd been. A shocking waste of money. Within about 3-4 weeks, I got an order to go to Lucknow to take over the military police detachment in Lucknow. This sounds surprising, doesn't it? Because I'd never done military police work in my life. But you were meant to learn it on the spot. And the first thing was, already you knew, being an officer, how to run a unit and all that type of stuff. You had to pick up the military police work as you went along, And Lucknow is a very big station. There must have been three battalions there, artillery, you name it, all types of troops there. And it's also, of course, a transit centre. Many of the railways came there, especially those going through onto Calcutta and then to Burma. Anyhow, I rather relished it, and I was my own boss. I had a very good sergeant major who, this officer knows nothing. He would say, no, I think we'd do it this way, so we've usually done it like this, and he sort of taught me. He really took me in hand, and I was very lucky there. I lived, because I didn't belong to any mess, and I didn't really want to belong to a mess and therefore be surrounded with all officers again, I lived in the club, and I was given a block where there were about five officers lived, which was mud-walled, mud huts, but built up especially for it. You could hear everything else the others did. I always remember the officer next to me in our tin tubs. Sub voce, very quietly, he could sing like Richard Tauber, exactly the same, the Austrian songs and everything. It'd be a joy to sit in my tub and just listen to him. Anyhow, that's aside. So I had this in Lucknow, and I don't think I dropped any clangers, and I found military police work interesting. I wasn't all set to go and arrest everybody on sight. My idea was that, if possible, you said to a guy, go on, don't be so bloody silly, push off, go back to your ranks. But if then he started arguing and fighting, okay, then you arrested him. That seemed to go down all right. There were certain ceremonial things to do when visiting generals, and that came. And, of course, it meant, and this was the joy of military police, I could go anywhere I liked in the outer bounds areas, and nobody could tick me off, because I was the guy that ticked everybody else off. And I found a very nice girl there too, Pathango. Poor old Shamshad. They said, would you like to take on slightly more difficult unit? I said, what do you mean by difficult? Thinking of war. And they said, no, down at Deolale, which is the homeward bound trooping depot for troops coming back to England. This was now, the war in England was just about finishing in April 45. And already men were being disbanded in England by a number system. I never quite understood it, but apparently everybody had a number of when they joined. You know, you were sort of, not your personal number, but a disbandment number. And so they would call in group 162, 163, 164, and they were meant to go down to Deolale, ship home. But this, like everything else in the world, began running behind time, and the men knew that their equivalent numbers in England were being disbanded, and they were still out in India and still at the trooping depot waiting to move. And this meant a lot of trouble, you know, drunkenness and arguments and fights and almost a revolt. And I was always having to go in with troops. My unit comprised British, Indian, Gurkhas, Sikhs, I had all that, and two halves, the Indian half and the British half. I had to be very careful which I used where, because you couldn't very well send an Indian military police in against a British group, you know, there'd be trouble, colour trouble straight away. So I always had my British in the camp most of the time. It was really just quietening down drunks and all that, but it went on a lot. And one amusing little thing, the Labour government got in, you remember, Churchill was heaved out to everybody's surprise. I can't remember the Minister of Defence's name, but he was a little Yorkshire miner, very small little man, and he was going to come out and visit the troops and explain to them. And I was called up to the brigade commander's office and told Emerson, under no circumstances will he be damaged. Nobody must get at him, because some troops were going to murder him. You know, they really wanted to have a go at him. I thought, oh God, how the hell do we do this? So I picked six over 6 footer policemen and surrounded him. People couldn't even talk to him. He had these six big men standing around him, and they weren't going to bloody move. But there were some scenes and that. Anyhow, his visit went off, and we got through it all right. But apart from that, it was really trying to keep that camp under control. The Japanese war ended, and at Nasik, which was about 10 miles away, the force that was going to be the occupation force started forming up. And they had their own military police unit. And I had thought of asking to apply for that, but to my amazement, suddenly I was told, report down to Secunderabad to the headquarters of the military police as the deputy assistant to the provost marshal. I thought, you know, what's that mean? Really, I was his chief staff officer, that's all. I still stayed, still a captain. And everybody else of my rank had all gone to major and things. I was quite happy. I had my pay and I was doing the job I liked, or I was happy in. So I went down there, but that was a boring job. I was sat in the same office as he was at a side table, and I was really like a sort of superior clerk, handling classified stuff and all that sort of stuff and so on. And then the BRIMDIV, which is the British Indian force that was going to, British Indian Division. They were the ones going up to the occupation of Japan, who were forming up in Nasik. They sent up a few people, advance parties and that. And there was a big party there one night, apparently. And the APM of the unit, that's the major in charge of the military police, the assistant provost marshal of the division, he drank far too much, and he went back to his tent, and he knocked over a paraffin lamp, and the tent went up in flames, and he with it. Of course, there was an immediate yell down to our office, quick, somebody needed for the BRIMDIV thing. And I said, I'd like that. He said, well, he said, yes, you're senior than anybody else. There was only, I think, one other regular officer, senior in CMPI. I think there were only three regulars altogether. The rest were all wartime officers. He said, well, you're senior enough. Okay, well, they've got to do it in a hurry. Well, go on. Off you go. So I said, right, up to Nasik. He said, no, you've got to go straight to Japan, because the APM was due to go to Japan. So I packed up my things, sent them back to my training center, took a couple of bags, train up to Calcutta, and then I had a five-day journey by air, because they were using Dakotas, and they couldn't go very far. So one went from Calcutta to Calcutta to Rangoon, Rangoon to the chief Vietnam town, Saigon, Saigon to Hong Kong, Hong Kong to Shanghai, and Shanghai into Japan. And at each place, you landed around tea time. You were free the whole of the evening and the afternoon until the next morning, when you set off after a very early breakfast. This was rather good, because I had, in a way, a half-world tour, seeing these places and the mess in them. The 7th Marines Commando were at Hong Kong at that time. In Shanghai were Chiang Kai-shek's troops. The only thing I remember about Shanghai is that I paid, I believe, something like 6.25 million yuan for a lemonade. The inflation was appalling. When they said, well, you want some money if you want to wander around town, I think I handed in something like £10. They almost gave me a suitcase of money back and said, I'm sorry, this is the inflation. And as I say, I paid something like 6 million something for a lemonade. Took off on the last day. This is a day always stuck in my mind. Partly, I suppose, I was landing in the enemy country in Japan. And we flew in across towards the Shimonoseki Straits, which is between the main island and the southern island of Shikoku. And the clouds came in, it started raining, buffeting. But somehow, looking down and seeing these very green islands and the inland sea, we flew right up it, and it's very beautiful, lots of islands dotted around. I thought, gosh, this looks a nice place. I wonder why the hell we had all this war and that. We landed at Iwakuni. One wheel of the Dakota hit a badly filled-in shell hole, and we went right down on one side and buckled a wing, and we thought, oh, we had no seats. We were sitting on mailbags and things. We bounced around inside and said, Lord, I think I've had it. Anyhow, we got out. We had one night at Iwakuni, and then I went up to Kure, and